You need to create stability first before you put in aid. How do you create the stable conditions where aid can be received, or trade for that matter?
Welcome to Foreign Policy. I'm David Rothkopf, CEO and editor, and this is the Editor's Roundtable. Today, I'm joined by FP contributor Rosa Brooks, Senior Future of War Fellow at New America Foundation and professor at Georgetown University. Also with us from California is another FP columnist, Corey Shockey, a research fellow at the Hoover Institution, where she focuses on military history and tanning. Finally, we have Ed Luce, the Financial Times chief U.S. commentator and columnist based in Washington, D.C. Recently, in our tiny podcast studio high above Washington's DuPont Circle, we had the following conversation. Hi, guys.
Hi, David.
So, I would like to talk a little bit about a subject we've never talked about on this podcast before, and that's economics. And I want to approach it, however, from the perspective of the intersection between economics and security and economics and politics. So, Corey, once upon a time, you wandered the halls of the Pentagon looking for your office. When you did, how many people did you encounter who actually understood the economic roots of the crises that you and your colleagues were deliberating on?
Well, back in the day when I was in the Pentagon in the early 1990s, a lot of people understood the economic underpinnings of Soviet collapse and the end of the Cold War. But one of the really shocking things about defense experts in the United States is that is the lack of numeracy. There is a belief that there's always going to be enough money. There is insufficient appreciation that the economy actually is America's most important national security tool. Mike Mullen said a couple of years ago when Secretary Gates first brought in the budget reduction, Mike Mullen mused that we have raised a whole generation of the American military who don't know anything about budgeting because they have never lived in a budget-constrained environment. And we are even now only beginning to scratch the surface of budget awareness in the defense community.
Rosa, you have wandered those halls more recently. What was your experience?
I think Corey is absolutely right. I think the biggest challenge for many DOD employees and contractors with responsibility for programs funded from the defense budget was often that they would reach the near the end of the fiscal year and not have expended the vast amounts of money that had been given to them or appropriated, and would suddenly be running around saying, find me something to spend my money on, because it looks bad if you ask for money and don't spend it. So we've been in an atmosphere in which the problem has been figuring out how to spend the excess money. I mean, that's obviously, I exaggerate a little bit. There have always been pockets of particular programs that people wanted to get funded but couldn't get funded. But by and large, the problem has been the opposite. I think it is a shock to the system to have to really think through what is it that we actually need to do, and how do we do it for a little bit less?
Ed, not only have you been distinguished writer for the Financial Times for a long time, which covers economic issues predominantly, you also worked for a while in consultation with the Treasury Department and leaders there, where all these issues are central. Yet the Treasury Department doesn't often talk to the Defense Department about these things. And the Defense Department, there seems to be, these silos in the U.S. government that make it hard to get our arms around things that we really need to. If you look at the Middle East, the crises there had their origins in economic crises, job crises, food price crises. If you look at Russia, there's an economic crisis that's pushing him towards taking security actions. If you look at China, the principal security concern of the Chinese is internal stability, et cetera, et cetera. And it seems to me that it's impossible to comprehend what's going on in the world today without being economically not just literate but engaged. Have you been exposed to similar phenomena to what Corey and Rosa were talking about?
Well, when I was Treasury speech writing for Larry Summers, that was the late 90s, and it was very interesting that clearly Treasury was the first amongst equals as a department. DOD was not we were in the so-called holiday of history period, and the DOD was not a big deal. When I came back to the U.S., I then went away. But when I came back in 2006, clearly Treasury was not an important department until Hank Paulson came in. Then it DOD was the big department, and that led the administration, Don Rumsfeld, Bob Gates, etc. Silos, definitely. I think that the Tony Blair phrase about needing joined-up government remains true in Britain. I don't think he achieved that aim, but it was a laudable way of identifying what needed to be done.
So there is something that is pertains to Tony Blair that is not discredited yet.
Yeah, my derision is in suspense. just this one instance, but the lack of joined up government in American administrations, and I think in this highly centralized administration, is even more acute than you'd have in Britain. A Treasury, to the extent it has a foreign policy role, is to do with its very effective sanctions unit.
You know, we have a different term for joined-up government here, which was quite fashionable early in the Obama administration, which was whole of government, acronym HWOG. That was
how did you spell whole? But
well, you know, W-H-O-G,
right.
HWOG or HOG or maybe WOG. Nobody could quite figure that one out. But in the early part of the Obama administration, that was the mantra. Those are the words on everyone's lips all the time. I was at the Defense Department, but we would say we need a whole of government approach. We really do. We go off to meetings at the White House with other federal agencies to talk about whatever the problem du jour was. And we'd say, guys, we really need a whole of government approach to this. It was such an abysmal failure insofar as the promised rebalancing of resources and authorities from the Defense Department to the civilian agencies never really occurred, that after a few years, people began to only say that phrase with little air quotation marks, and finally they more or less stopped saying it altogether.
Well, it's one of those Washington things where, you know, we could do a whole show here on just the big lies in Washington, you know, the statements that mean the opposite of what you say. So the more you say whole of government, the less you actually mean whole of government. The most, you know, you go into a meeting and someone will say, well, I obviously know less about this subject than all of you in the room.
Which means the opposite.
It means I know more than about.
So shut up. Yeah, but,
exactly. Or, you know, the distinguished gentle lady from wherever. And, you know,
yes,
what you really
I
mean.
Hate you.
I hate you. Right, exactly.
It's a really interesting point, but stupid.
Yeah, right.
Exactly. Can I make a plea that we actually do that show?
Yes, yes,
I
yes.
I would actually like the writ large. Here are things people say in Washington. In fact, Rosa, didn't you write a column about this?
I don't know, but what would you add to the list? Because, you know, we can take this wherever we want to take it. So
absolutely.
If you want to talk about Washington hypocrisy, I'm all ears.
I think I did a piece on military and national security euphemisms and what they really mean in code.
So in keeping with the whole of government mantra, I feel like we should expand Rosa's, here's what the military says and what they really mean, and do a separate show about translating for actual people the things said in Washington that actually don't mean what they said. But for the moment, on the issue of whole of government operations, it's absolutely true that we've been a country at war for 15 years, and we still have a dearth of people who can integrate across economic and political and intelligence and military elements of strategy. And that's because we have such a wide margin of error as a country that we tend to just be sloppy.
Rosa just handed me her cell phone.
I sent him a secret message.
And from her article, in which she's providing definitions here, and it says, this will require a whole of government effort. And the translation is, this will take a miracle. We definitely can't do it. And it says her prior interpretations include, I think this is someone else's job. That's a concurrent interpretation.
It is, indeed.
It's like, by the way, boots on the ground.
Yes.
Which means you're out of your fucking mind.
Boots on the ground has a very specific meaning. If it's not a certain brand of boots, then they don't actually count in what the Defense Department terms the BOG numbers, the boots on the ground numbers. You know, DOD actually, in addition to having the old and now discarded acronym WOG, we also have BOG, which is boots on the ground, and we make charts and so forth. I shouldn't say we anymore, but DOD makes
my favorite DOD, and you must be familiar with this euphemism in terms of sort of mangling English, is situational awareness is a force multiplier. And I love that, because what it means is if your soldiers know where they are, you need fewer of them.
They're all lost. If they're completely lost, you need an entire division.
Right.
Right. But, you know, if they're actually in the right place, you can get by with one or two.
Exactly.
Especially if they're Marines, in which case you only need half of them to get
exactly.
the job done.
In defense of the American military, I have to say they have also come up with the very best acronym, right?
Which is?
Well, let's see.
SNAFU.
SNAFU is an old one, but a good one.
The top of the list.
Whiskey Tango Foxtrot.
Yep.
Yeah, so they dominate the polar ends of the spectrum, both the best and the worst that can be contributed. On a serious point about whole of government operations, though, because I have a missionary zeal about the fact that we are allowing to accrue to the military functions that are inherently civilian in American foreign policy, and we do that because the other organizations, USAID springs to mind, aren't actually doing their piece of the job well enough. And in many cases, it's not a lack of money. The State Department budget has gone up dramatically since 2002. It's that they don't actually, you know, it's a professional culture issue in the Foreign Service that they are not as good at their jobs. And so when things get to be important, we push them into the military because they will analyze it in a reasonable way, break it down into tasks that are achievable, and get to work on it.
But
and
Corey,
it's also that they have all the money.
I want to defend the Foreign Service officers, though. I think that it does go back to the issue of money. There are many Foreign Service officers who are fantastic at their jobs, but their hands are tied in a thousand different ways. Embassies abroad, if you're in a State Department employee, you can, in many countries, barely leave the embassy compound. That was true even before Benghazi. I'm sure it's only gotten worse. I remember being quite shocked going from working as a freelance consultant for human rights groups and traveling all over the place in various post-conflict and conflict-ridden situations to working for the State Department and being told, you can't go anywhere, you can't go there, you can't go here. That makes it awfully hard for them to do their jobs, our sort of total risk aversion. Add to that the fact that we may have problems with professional and continuing military education, but we do have the money and we send our military personnel back to school repeatedly. The kinds of education available to those in the Foreign Service and civil service workers at state are really minimal and really inadequate. So we're putting them in a position where we're in part because of money, although not entirely because of money, it's awfully tough for them to do the jobs that we ask them to do. And then, of course, we get mad at them and we say, oh, the State Department, they're so useless. They just, you know, you can't rely on
them. But there's another dimension of this, which also has to do with money, which is kind of meta in the conversation about economics. But as you were indicating earlier, it's almost sacrilegious in the United States to talk about reducing the amount of money that goes to the Department of Defense. But it's also almost sacrilegious in the United States to talk about increasing the amount of money that goes to aid the things that prevent wars or the things that stabilize and help you win the peace, which is absolutely ludicrous. You know, if you said this is a budget that is designed to promote stability, you'd be spending your money, you know, vastly more on economic things, political things, infrastructure things, development-related things, and much less on blowing crap up.
Well, the crap's got to be blown up. You know, you can't have crap sitting around.
I agree with David's point, right? I mean, half of the businesses begun in the United States go under. It's a natural part. And yet we build aid programs in which nothing is permitted to fail. They're like the Soviet five-year plans from the 1950s. That's how we allocate foreign assistance. To go back to Congress and say, yeah, we gave money to all of these enterprises and half of them failed, it's money well spent, is a very hard case to make. But I don't want to let this issue of professionalization slip away before pounding the table one more time, like for Trump. Yeah. Because both of the examples Rosa used are not examples of money. They're examples of professionalization, education, and security. So the last three secretaries of state have actually added people to the Foreign Service in order to create a float for education. And the Foreign Service has never used those 2,000 people to that purpose. They have plussed up embassy places. So it's not a function of money. It's that partly that the people who come into the Foreign Service are already well-educated, right? The Foreign Service actually has an admissions rate more demanding than Stanford University. They have
There's something more demanding than Stanford University?
The Foreign Service has 16 qualified applicants for every person they accept. And yet, by their own admission, the last two QDDRs, they do not hire people with the skills they say they need, they don't train them, and they keep them all. So that's not a money problem. That's a lack of managerial attention problem.
But Ed, there's another dimension to this. We're talking about this, But you know, the other dimension is the economic roots of conflict, the economic...
David, you're ringing.
Yep, that wasn't me. That was Ed. there are economic roots of conflict, and there are economic solutions to conflict. And if you don't understand those things, how can you possibly win a war? How can you possibly stabilize a situation? If you look at the Middle East right now, which is a complete swirling, I've thought of a lot of acronyms and euphemisms, and I'm just going to skip over all of them, but one involves a goat. the problem is that not what we're doing now, which is tough. The problem is that to actually stabilize Syria and rebuild it, to stabilize and rebuild Iraq, to stabilize and rebuild Yemen, to stabilize and rebuild Libya is going to cost a couple of $100 billion. Nobody knows where it's going to come from. It's actually easier for us to figure out an acceptable policy to maintain stirring the pot with not quite earnest efforts at winning a war than it is to try and find an earnest way to end it.
Well, I mean, there was talk in 2011, 2012, when the Arab Spring began after Tunisia started, of amongst the more wide-eyed idealist types in Washington of a Marshall plan for the Middle East, and in spite of some of the naivete, particularly about what the what traffic Capitol Hill will bear, which is namely zero on foreign aid increases. In spite of that, I think that was a very germane, very encouraging debate to be hearing around that time. It was thinking larger, thinking longer term, thinking more strategic, thinking where are the West's interests, where are America's interests aligned long term in the Middle East? And they're with the youth, they're with the unemployed, they're with those who face zero economic prospects, who will turn to Salafism, who will turn to all kinds of things that will be against our interests unless they have better economic prospects.
Look
at Saudi Arabia.
Right. Creating jobs for young Arab men is more likely to lead to peace in the region than killing them.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And the fact that that has run into the sand. Actually, President Obama himself, in an interview with Tom Friedman, made this point very, very eloquently earlier this year, that this is the number one national security challenge coming from the Middle East is male youth unemployment. The question I would have in response to your question is, how much traction does the United States have on this? I mean, you need to create stability first before you put in aid. How do you create the stable conditions where aid can be received, or trade for that matter?
Yeah, I will accept your stinging rebuke about the Foreign Service, but so now I'll switch back to defending the military. I think people understand that in the Defense Department. I think at every level people get that basic reality, and indeed it's a source of a lot of frustration, which is to say people in the military rightly say, look, we are a Band-Aid at best in terms of what we can do in these extremely complicated, extremely messy situations. We can't fix the Middle East economy. We can't protect the Middle East. The latest problem, as I'm sure you've all read, is that now temperatures are predicted to make much of the Middle East literally uninhabitable to humans by the end of the century. You know, we can't solve that problem if we're in the military. We can't fix broken governance systems. We can't change cultures. You know, we can't build the rule of law. That's not what we're trained to do. You're not equipping us to do that. You're not sending us the right people. You're not even giving us the right mission set to do that. So don't we totally get it. But that goes back to that whole fabled whole of government challenge that I don't think the problem is that the Defense Department doesn't fully appreciate the importance of the economic roots of conflict. I think that the challenge is that they don't see that as something that they are either trained to handle or are really being asked by the nation to handle, but there's nobody else to do it.
I don't want to let what you just said go by without an additional comment, and maybe Corey or Ed, you have something to add to it. But yeah, I saw that story too about how temperatures are likely to rise above the habitable level in some of these Gulf states. And they're already, they'll go to 122, 125. This year in Iran, I think there was a temperature index reading of 140 or 150. I mean, it's some ridiculously off the charts.
And in Pakistan, they had the record temp. I mean, there were hundreds of deaths from heat.
Highest. The Iran was the highest such index ever recorded on the planet. Mm-hmm. And it was a couple of months ago. And you think oil is a mythological curse on this region. It contains temptation. It contains the seeds of social destruction. And for everything it gives, it also takes away. You know, it rises these countries up, makes them interesting only to tear them apart and cast them down.
It's what development experts refer to as the resource curse. There was a famous in wonk circles study by Paul Collier for the World Bank 20 years back now, looking at the roots of civil conflict. And, you know, he was trying to figure out, okay, so what are the best predictors of civil conflict in a country? Is it ethnic cleavages? Is it ideology and ideological cleavages, et cetera? Is it economic inequality? And what he found was the single factor that was most effective at predicting the likelihood of civil conflict was capturable natural resources. That if you got stuff that's worth a lot of money, whether it's oil or whether it's diamonds or precious minerals, that's a pretty good predictor that people are going to start fighting over that, both insiders and outsiders, and you're going to have conflict and instability.
That's why my money for the next 10 years, I bet that the place in the world that will make the most headlines and have the most conflict that we talk about the least today will be Central Asia, and with Africa as a close
runner-up. West Africa shortly afterwards. But, you know, we...
I'm sorry, since I'm not in the studio, I'm a little bit out of sync with the conversation.
You should interrupt us.
I want to voice myself out of my reverie at David's use of mythological curses in describing what's going on to point out that there is a lot of research that actually suggests that the resource curse is only the resource correlation, right? Because quality of
government.
is what makes it. Norway has no trouble, despite the fact that they struck oil. Britain has no trouble, despite it. It's a governance issue. It's not. So what you see, where you tend to see civil conflict, is places where you have weak governance and resources. But you also see a lot of conflict where you have simply weak governance.
Well, it depends. It depends on what kind of what dimension of the mythological curse you're going to talk about. Britain is an island, and it will be a smaller island if things keep going the way they're going. And I don't just mean its own diminishment on the international stage, but literally, it'll be smaller. The traditional definition of resource curse obviously goes to these issues of governance, but it seems even larger in scale than all of that. Is that the reason you've moved to the United States, Ed?
Well, I've been here a while, but if you mean by Britain getting smaller, Scotland breaking off.
Or you're fleeing the rising sea levels.
The rising sea levels is another factor. I think the sort of breaking off chunks of territory is perhaps a bit more imminent. I mean, it's worth noting that the Scottish yes campaign in the referendum last year was predicated on high oil prices being the basis of their fiscal future. And if they had voted yes, they would now be in the Greek status, in the Greek category.
And by the way, if Britain gets smaller because it loses its beaches, it's one of the few places in the world where no one will care, because British beaches are awful. They're cold.
It's where
we. Windy.
It's where we fight invaders.
Yeah,
that's they have an important role.
Always new beaches. Love that. Could we have another episode on mythological curses?
Well, actually, all episodes are on mythological curses. It's interesting, however, that a dimension of all of this is, what do we do next in these places where there is conflict? And, we've talked in recent episodes on Afghanistan. And, there seems to be a general consensus among anybody who spent 5 minutes studying that we really ought to get out. There's some debate about whether we should get out right away or in a little bit. And the argument against getting out right away is it's all going to come crashing down on us. That was, what happened essentially in Iraq. In these kind of situations, how can you possibly get out without, having something stabilizing to offer in the place of the barrel of a gun?
But, this goes back to, I think, something implicit in an earlier point that Ed made, which is if we can't do it, we can't do it. And it's kind of irrelevant to say, well, we ought to do it, or we would really be good and best if we did it. If we can't do it, we can't. And I think that it's not totally clear to me, A, that we, the United States, have the ability, we have the requisite tools and capabilities and political will and finances to do much of anything that is going to, quote unquote, stabilize Afghanistan, much less Syria, much less Libya, et cetera. It's also not completely clear to me that we should be trying to do that. Our record is not fantastic. Our record at stabilization is not so great. I think we talked about
it's
this
terrible.
In an earlier episode.
It's terrible.
Yeah, that doctors take an oath, physicians take an oath to first do no harm. And that's, I think, an oath that foreign policy folks should probably take too, that we have, we're the equivalent of the Good Samaritan who stops at a car accident, rushes up to the victim who's tossed out of the car, eager to help, and shakes them and ends up, making their injuries even worse instead of saying either, let's wait for somebody who knows what they're doing or let's let them figure this out.
Wait a minute.
And that's kind of what we do a lot around the globe.
Is this the first Ben Carson commercial that
had
on this podcast?
Oh, no, I'm so sorry.
And that you want to elect a president who's taken the Hippocratic Oath because perhaps he won't?
I don't really want to elect Ben Carson, but I would actually, I think that that's an oath that people should take more seriously. I think a lot of the ruin that we have created around the world has not come from cynicism. It's come from idealism that is not matched by our actual capabilities.
And I have a good example. I mean, I was based in India before and after 9/11, which meant I got diverted to Pakistan. And I remember then what we're hearing today, most recently last week, earlier this month, when Nawaz Sharif met Obama in the White House, which was American aid coming through for civil reengineering of Pakistan education system to move school kids away from madrasas, to build up NGOs, free media, etc. Colin Powell was talking about that then. John Kerry, who of course was his key ally in the Senate, is talking about it now. $20 billion later, the needle hasn't moved a tiny bit. This is good intentions. But as we know, to David's question, nothing is going to change in Afghanistan until Pakistan is a strong and willing partner and not speaking with forked tongue every time it's consulted on Afghanistan. And I don't know if any American president, even if Kissinger was working for him, can find a key that's going to unlock this Pakistan
even
conundrum.
Even Kissinger? Even if somebody
Kissinger.
Is enlightened, as Henry was in Indonesia and Cambodia and Laos and Chile.
As entrepreneurial, I think I put it. Although, even if you had an empowered Richard Holbrooke, who was actually doing all sorts of funny diplomatic maneuvers that he wanted to do that Obama stopped him from doing, whoever is going to try this is going to fail.
Where do you come out on this, Corey? Throw up your hands and just say, we shouldn't be messing in these places. Let history take its course. Over time, poverty, you know, the number of people living in absolute poverty declines. The middle class gets bigger. This is a stabilizing effect. It's gradually going to come to these places. It won't be fast. What we should do is sort of cordon them off and let sort of the Steven Pinker view of the world take over, and things will get better.
Ooh,
and we'll stop
this
fighting
is not
more.
Fair.
Should we actually be playing some role in trying to influence events during our lifetime?
When you put it like that, David.
Even before David pitched that one slow and right over the middle of the plate, I am still in the space that doing nothing also leads to bad consequences, and doing nothing also bears moral culpability. It's not at all clear to me that, as Martin Luther King and President Obama say, that the arc of history bends towards justice. And even if that's true, because bad guys win a lot of the time, it's not true that good guys always win. And second, it also seems to me that the cost of doing nothing weighs very, very heavily in the squandering of human potential. And a third reason for doing something, even when we're wrong, is that it does seem to me that one of the reasons that the United States' dominance of the international order may prove more sustainable than the dominance of other hegemons is that mostly people want us to succeed. And the reason they want us to succeed is American soft power, is that we do actually care about lifting people out of poverty. We do actually very often try and do the right thing. And that accrues to our credit when we bungle, which is very often. And I'll just close this little sermon with the historian Arnold Toynbee saying, the United States is like a very large dog in a very small room. It starts wagging its tail and it knocks all the furniture over.
Well, maybe. Oh, sorry, Toynbee.
We mostly knock all the furniture over, and yet people still want us to intervene when they have problems.
But we don't actually knock all the furniture over. And let me just, I'm going to continue with my thesis here as we sort of move towards the conclusion of this particular podcast. But, you know, the United States has been the most powerful country in the world, certainly since the Second World War. And here in the United States, when we look at our foreign policy, we say, well, you know, Korea's still divided, Russia's still a problem, Vietnam didn't turn out so well, what the heck were we doing in Beirut or Grenada? These wars in the Middle East have just made the Middle East a worse place. We keep meddling, things keep getting worse. And yet, 70 years later, life expectancies everywhere are greater. Economic conditions virtually everywhere are better. There's more democracy by far than there was. There's more stability. Fewer people are dying in wars. There's more respect for international law. There's more institutions that are working, not well, but there are institutions that existed in this period. All this U.S. meddling, for all the failures we talk about, seems... And again, correlation, causation, we can talk about it.
In spite of U.S. meddling. I mean, I think this is...
But if we're the most powerful force in the world, is global progress really in spite of us?
You're not the most powerful force in the world, and global progress isn't happening because you invaded Iraq. It's because you're upholding the global commons.
Yeah, David, take that.
It's because you, sorry, you, us. We, I mean,
all of a sudden, Ed has become incredibly Canadian, but keep going.
It's because of the non-interventions that America upholds. I mean, it's because of the international trading system. It's because of the freedom of navigation.
Wait, we intervened to create the international trading system. No progress has been made international trade without the United States. We created the system of international financial institutions.
True.
No progress has been made without those. Most... of the aid efforts, of whether it's the Marshall Plan on, has had us playing a big role in those things. When I say intervention, I don't just mean military intervention. The United States has played a constructive role in engaging with the world.
So you're circling back to the original question, which is how do we recognize and act on the recognition that economic roots of conflict are very significant, and we can't just run around blowing stuff up. We have to take that more seriously, and I think nobody's gonna disagree with that. The challenge though is telling the difference between interventions that have a reasonable likelihood of success and interventions that don't. And I don't think we're very good at that. I mean, I certainly agree with Corey. There are times when you can't do nothing, you know, and there are times when doing nothing is even worse than an intervention, military or non-military, that is likely to have significant problems, you know. But I think that we do not have a governmental system within the executive branch nor a political system supporting that smiles upon going through the serious exercise of saying, what is the problem? What can we bring to the table? How long are we likely to be able to sustain these resources? Do we have the skills? How long are we likely to be able to sustain the political will if X, Y, and Z go wrong, which they might very well? That's the kind of conversation that we, including in the military, are fairly bad at having. I mean, in the military, people are quite good at having that conversation about the strictly military pieces of it, which is to say, you know, if we put these troops here and try to get that objective, what if this goes wrong? What's our backup plan? But as a government, much less as a whole of government, we're terrible at having those conversations. I think my bias towards, hey, we need to really ask ourselves, can we and should we get involved in place X or Y more than we already are, isn't premised on a belief that it is never worthwhile or right or appropriate to intervene, but it is premised on a fairly strong sense, both from experience and from looking at the historical record, that we fairly consistently overestimate our capabilities and overestimate our resources and political will.
Corey, the last question is going to go to you here for this podcast. We use the term sometimes smart power. I'm always skeptical of that because it tends to mean I'm smarter than you power. You know, it's one of those loaded terms. But when we do, we tend to mean soft power, economic power, political power, other kinds of interventions. And if you sort of follow the thread of the last couple minutes of this conversation, it seems to be that we intervene overseas politically or economically, or we intervene via the rule of law or international institutions. The record, net, not perfect, is pretty good, and militarily, not so good. Is military power dumb power?
Military power is dumb power when it is used as an alternative to seriously solving a problem. So a few pinprick airstrikes is dumb military power. Smart power generally, is to have a political end state and then ascribe the means that can get you to achieving it. So the military power can be dumb power. It's very often dumb power because since we are better at it than we are at the other elements of national power, in part because we better resource it, in part because there's a strong ethos of professionalization in the American military, we default to doing that instead of having a strategy to achieve a political end state.
Okay. Well, we haven't solved all the world's problems here. But we'll do that in the next podcast, I'm sure. I want to thank Corey and Ed and Rosa for a great discussion. And I hope that those of you who are out there listening enjoyed it and enjoyed enough to come back and join us another time on the Editor's Roundtable. Thank you very much. You have been listening to Foreign Policy's The ER Podcast. I'm David Rothkopf, and I've been your host. The program is produced by Maria Ori and Ann Kingston. For more information about FP and to subscribe, please visit foreignpolicy.com. And thank you very much for joining us.